characters writing letters within Victorian novels are quite common. They are usually to be found, the main protagonists, and generally belong to the educated class. In Wuthering Heights, for example, Isabel Linton's letter to Nellie Dean, explaining what has happened to her after she eloped with Heathcliff, takes up most of chapter 13. Nellie has kept this letter, for as she says, any relic of the dead is precious if they were valued living. She reads it some 20 years later to Mr. Lockwood as part of a wider story she's telling about her masters and mistresses, the Earnshaws, the Lintons, and the Heathcliffs. Alison Casey's rewriting Wuthering Heights from the point of view of Nellie Dean is a neo-Victorian cockerel of Wuthering Heights. It is indeed a contemporary fiction set in the 19th century, so that's neo-Victorian, evoking events that are simultaneous with the source text, so a cockerel, and taking place in the same diegetic universe as their pre-text. It retells in more detail incidents familiar to the readers of Wuthering Heights and adds a number of related episodes and characters directly linked to Nellie, like her mother and old Dr. Kenneth's son. This cockerel is constructed as a monologic epistolary novel, focusing on the letters of only one character, here Nellie Dean, who, from the passive recipient of letters in Wuthering Heights, has become an active letter writer herself. The novel is divided into 27 chapters, plus an unnumbered postscript, and consists of three letters written by Nellie at different times, and all starting with "Dear Mr. Lockwood." Therefore, the epistolary novel's typical result in its more usual polylogic form of changing points of view as individual perspectives are presented by the different letter-writing characters, as in La Close, Les Liaisons Dangereuses, for example, does not appear here. There are also letters from other characters transcribed by Nellie, two letters from her mother and one from her father in chapter 5 and 27, clearly differentiated from the main letter by the use of italics. These letters, important as they are in the plot, do not really alter the monologic nature of the novel. Nellie is indeed in sole charge of the narrative. We shall first study these three letters and the related question of their recipient, and then, if we have time, we'll consider Nellie as a writer in this neo-Victorian novel. The first letter spans the bulk of the novel, straddling as it does 26 chapters out of 27. It retells the events related in the source text, from Heathcliff's arrival at Wuthering Heights in September 1771, which Nellie describes as marking the end of her childhood, to a few months after the second Catherine and Hareton's wedding at the beginning of 1803. After the wedding, Nellie has been sent to rest by the seaside, where, for once in her busy life, she has a lot of free time on her hands, and finding, as she says, her mind turning more and more to the past, she begins to write what we have just read. The main point of this letter is the story of her love affair with Hindley Earnshaw, which takes center stage and pushes Heathcliff and Catherine's own story, which is at the very heart of Wuthering Heights, into the background, and thus creates a parallel story to the one in the source text. This love story between Hindley and Nellie is not totally improbable within the framework of the hypertext. In that regard, Nellie Dean, as Françoise Krall says, picks up on the ambiguity already present in the Brontean text and positions herself in its footsteps as a magnifying lens or an echo chamber which chooses to amplify the half-voiced and half-silenced clues, rather than simply filling in the narrative blanks of a canonical text. Indeed, many readers and critics of Wuthering Heights have noted Nellie's partiality for Hindley, for example, in his 1956 essay, John Matheson remarks that Nellie is actively taking the part of Hindley while he is tormenting the child Heathcliff, and that the most Nelly can admit is that Hindley was a bad example for Heathcliff. For her part, and that's the quotation, the first quotation you have, Samantha Pribilovic tries and analyzes Nelly's obvious bias. Okay, she says, well, you have a quotation, as a child, Hindley is described as degrading, etc., etc., etc. So, and also Sandra Gilbert, in one of the articles of The Mad Woman in the Attic, hints that Nelly's history has paralleled the lives of Catherine and Isabella. Hindley, for instance, was evidently once as close to Nelly as Heathcliff was to Catherine. This closeness is taken a step further in Nelly Dean. As Alison Case herself says in an interview, Cathy and Heathcliff tear each other apart emotionally in ways not unlike what Hindley does to Nelly. I wanted to explore the impact of that kind of love on someone who is herself more, quote, normal, more broadly affectionate, less singular and obsessive in her love. This first letter develops the burgeoning and the end of a love story between the two young people. The description of their first lovemaking in the cave during a dark and stormy night, just before Hindley is sent away to college by his father in October 1774, is very subdued and understated, quite unlike many sex scenes in neo-Victorian novels. And she says, our refuge kept dry and crammed in as we were. It soon warmed up as well. Do I really need to tell you what happened next? Remember that we thought ourselves as good as betrothed, and I loved him. Yes, there on our heavy bed in that little earthen chamber, I loved him with all my heart. The consequence of this love affair between Nelly and Hindley are momentous, for Nelly is pregnant. The reader of Wuthering Heights knows that there is no mention of a child by Nelly's or Hindley's child in the source text. And since it is a cockerel, Nelly Dean cannot deviate to that extent from the original storyline. And so, indeed, Nelly is going to miscarry, or rather, to have an abortion induced by a potion her mother forces her to drink. Whereas the sex scenes are very elusive, the description of the abortion is quite detailed, and this signals and identifies the novel as contemporary and is another example of a modern-day presence in the text, since no respectable Victorian novel would deal explicitly with sex-related issues. Given the intimate nature of the letter, the choice of Mr. Lockwood as addressee is somewhat surprising. As Nelly says at the beginning, he certainly does not expect to hear from her after his leaving Frostcross Grange for the second time in September 1802. It's precisely dated in Wuthering Heights. Having been told the updated story of Heathcliff's death 3 months earlier and Hareton and Cathy's upcoming wedding in the following New Year. Nelly then makes the purpose of her letter clear. She wants to tell him her own story. And that's the second quotation you have. The story I didn't tell. All right. And she says also, so at the end of the quotation, I've imagined myself again and again telling you all those other things and you taking an interest in them as a story, you know, as you did that other tale. However, there is little chance of that happening. As Bronte's snobbish Mr. Lockwood's remark about Nelly in Wuthering Heights suggests, as he says, she was no gossip, I fear, unless about her own affairs, and those could hardly interest me. Okay? So, Nelly's first task in the letter is to try and convince Mr. Lockwood that her own affairs are as interesting as her master's and therefore worthy of being told. The idea that in a politically correct contemporary literary context, servants and masters are equally deserving of a narrator protagonist status because they all have an equally interesting, albeit different, life experience to relate, is in keeping with a basic assertion found in many neo-Victorian novels that every individual, regardless of race, gender, or class, is equally compelling and therefore qualified to be a protagonist deserving of a voice. That's Jeremy Rosen. This view is deeply compatible with the equalitarian values of a 21st century liberal readership, still according to Jeremy Rosen, and is another sign of a contemporaneity of a novel. This is echoed by Nelly herself, in the third quotation, when she realizes that, after all, there is little chance of Mr. Lockwood being interested in her story. Okay? So she says, who would be interested in such a story as mine compared to the destructive passions of highborn ladies and gentlemen, etc.? Certainly not you, Mr. Lockwood, and so on. So, she has no illusion about the class-prejudiced Mr. Lockwood and realizes that he would certainly feel no sympathy for her and no interest in her story. He would probably be on the side of the aristocratic Charles Smithson in the mock Victorian ending in chapter 44 of John Fowle's The French Lieutenant's Woman, who exclaims, "Who could be bothered with a biography of servants? They married and bred and died in the monotonous fashion of their kind." As Jeremy Rosen puts it, this new narrative point of view clearly manipulates the 21st century readers who tend to adhere to a set of consensus values of liberal pluralism. And that's the next quotation. In the service of a production of sympathy, concern, and identification with a previously minor character who was not, by virtue of the minorness, the principal object of concern in the precursor text. Okay? And so the narrative priority is the representation of a character's rich interiority, a subjectivity that was not represented in the precursor text. As Nelly's letter turns into a confession, it's her word, exploring her own rich interiority, she begins to question her choice of addressee. Okay? And that's quotation five. Why do I write this to you? Okay? So this is a self-reflexive angle to the letter. Okay? Saying that, would you read it through? And if you did, who would you share it with your friends and acquaintances, or would you read the first few pages, grow weary, and sleep the rest in the fire? Okay. She then concludes with a pun on Mr. Lockwood's name, who has by then become the recipient of a letter by default, so to speak. No, I will never send it to you. And she says, I address you, and this is the end of quotation five, I address you as Mr. Lockwood because I must address myself to somebody, but it could as sensibly be Mr. Knockwood, for I do feel sometimes, as I think on the trials of sorrows of the past, how fortunate I am to be done with them, that I should knock on wood, or better, Mr. Lockhart, for truly these things might be better kept in my heart. So, nonetheless, she continues with the writing of a letter, which then becomes a sort of therapy, re-entering those years of shame and anger and grief beyond all bearing, as she says, will allow her to come to terms with her traumatic past. The first letter thus ends with Nelly wondering what she's going to do with a stack of paper her initial letter has turned into, and who will ever read it, for so far she has only decided who she is not writing for. I will never send this to you, Mr. Lockwood, Mr. Knockwood, Mr. Lockhart, she reiterates a bit later, and she also states, I do not write this for the second Catherine. The second letter corresponds to the last chapter of the novel, written about a year after the first one and after the end of the source novel. Nelly explains that she had put the first letter out of her sight, tied up with a red ribbon, wrapped in an old linen pillowcase, and put it under some blankets in the trunk before pulling it out again in order to finish her story. For much has happened since the end of the first letter, and the ending of Nelly Dean is to be different from the ending of Wuthering Heights. As is to be expected, because this is a neo-Victorian novel, this letter contains revelations about the main characters, mostly of a sexual nature. But unlike other rewritings of Wuthering Heights that I have read, these family secrets, which are finally revealed, do not concern Heathcliff, but Nelly herself. Okay, her mother's deathbed letter, reproduced by Nelly, which she finds among all Joseph's papers after his death, retrospectively shed a new light onto the whole story. In it, Mary Dean confesses that Nelly is in fact Mr. Earnshaw's illegitimate daughter, and so Hindley and the first Catherine's half-sister, and Hareton and Catherine's, the second Catherine's, aunt. The love affair between Nelly and Hindley, which is at the heart of the first letter, was thus incestuous. Mrs. Dean confirms what Nelly and the reader had suspected all along but never understood. She deliberately gave Nelly an abortive potion when she found out that she was pregnant. She says, "You see why I had to interfere between you and Hindley, and why I could not let you bear his child," she writes, asking for her daughter's forgiveness. The suggestion of possible incestuous relations between the main characters of Wuthering Heights has been explored in other neo-Victorian novels. In The Lost Child, for example, Carol Phillips goes as far as to suggest that Heathcliff is indeed Earnshaw's son, instead of being a usurper, and thus Hindley and Catherine's half-brother. Emma Tennant even doubles the incestuous link between the characters, not only by making Heathcliff Mr. Earnshaw's son, but also by revamping the second Catherine as Heathcliff's daughter. She even has the demonic Heathcliff exclaim, "My Cathy, my little Cathy, is my daughter, and I begot her on my own sister. She weds Linton tomorrow." Marrying her to his son by Isabella Linton is thus, so to speak, instead in incest to the square. Lynn Hare Sargent's novel also suggests, albeit less explicitly, that the second Catherine is Heathcliff's daughter by having Mr. Lockwood remark on her extraordinary dark eyes, a clue unmissed by the reader, because Heathcliff's eyes are often described as such throughout the sequel. What is new in Nelly Dean is that Hindley and Nelly's unwitting breaking of incest taboo that is explored, and not the nature of a relationship between the much more romantic and charismatic Catherine and Heathcliff. So, Nelly's letter is not explains a great deal, but and that's the next quotation. In fact, it is preempted in the text by a letter in Nelly's letter. By her childhood friend, who has then succeeded his father, Dr. Kenneth's son, so who knew about the nature of the relationship. And so, Nelly's last short letter to Mr. Lockwood, written in italics in a postscript, is different in style and nature from the other two. To start with, it is in fact an answer to a letter by Mr. Lockwood, never directly quoted but only referred to, in replies to yours of the 18th of June, telling Nelly that he is engaged to be married and offering her a job as housekeeper of his London establishment. Unlike the other two, this letter is going to be sent to Mr. Lockwood. Moving ahead a few years, it goes far beyond the ending of Wuthering Heights, which is fairly rare in a Cockwall. Indeed, as Armelle Paré notes, Cockwalls do not usually disrupt the original ending of their source text. The letter thus provides a new happy ending for all the remaining characters, of the novel. In it, Nellie tells Mr. Lockwood that Kathy and Harriton's modest wedding went off as planned. The pair are now happily settled. They have a little girl. Kathy is expecting her second confinement. And she tells him that she is about to marry Dr. Robert Kenneth and hopes to have a child of her own. So this new feel-good and optimistic closure, somewhat paradoxically, is more conventional than its precursors, which ends, after all, by a visit by Mr. Lockwood to the graves of the main characters, who even in death continue to dominate the story. In this new ending, the emphasis is on domesticity rather than passion, the living rather than the dead. And this is one of the last quotations. She goes back to the idea that her life has been as interesting, after all, as her master's. To conclude, this rewriting is certainly a rewriting, R-I-G-H-T-I-N-G, of Nellie Dean, because, in fact, Nellie Dean has been criticized or considered by many critics as a villain in the story. Okay, and so her own she is in this way securing the reader's sympathy and compassion. So the difference between other neo-Victorian weddings, and this is my last sentence, is that it's not a parody. It does not criticize, vilify, make fun of the main characters. Okay, as Alison Case herself says, I had no wish to falsify the original. I wanted my story to deepen and complicate the original, not to undermine and simplify it. So it is, in fact, a homage to Wuthering Heights. And while amplifying some of the half-voiced and half-silenced clues of the source text, it does not alter our perspective of it in the way Jean Rhys's White Saga Sea did with Charlotte Bronte's Jane Eyre. Okay, thank you.